My name is David Shepherd. I'm Director of Research for Arts and Humanities and Director of this, the Humanities Research Institute. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome everybody to this latest in the series of inaugural lectures hosted by the HRI. As I always point out at this stage in my introduction, these lectures are intended to offer opportunities for professors in the Arts and Humanities Division to spell out their vision for the development of their subject and thereby bring the excellence of humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience, both within and beyond the university. And while we will be hearing such a lecture this evening, a lecture that will, in the usual way, be recorded and made available on the HRI's website as soon as possible, today's sequence of events is just a little bit different. This is my second spell as director of the HRI. Towards the end of my first, back in summer 2003, I was privileged to be present at the launch of the first version of the Old Bailey Proceedings Online website. It's been no less of a pleasure and a privilege to be involved in overseeing the support offered by the HRI's specialist ICT staff for the newly expanded version of the Proceedings of the Central Criminal Court, and to witness the extraordinary positive publicity that this flagship publication of our publishing arm, HRI Online, has garnered in the last few weeks. I'm sure everybody here has seen at least some of that publicity, heard some of it as well. So this evening's occasion is really, as well as an inaugural lecture, a celebration, a formal launch, if you will, of that new publication. Now, projects such as the Proceedings of the Old Bailey Online are, of course, collaborations. And it's therefore only fitting that we should this evening hear from all three co-directors of the second phase of the Old Bailey project. First, Professor Clive Emsley of the Open University will talk to us about the new website, about what it makes possible for historians and others to do that they couldn't have done before. Then Professor Tim Hitchcock of the University of Hertfordshire will say something about current and future research that springs from the Old Bailey project. And finally, we will hear from Professor Bob Shoemaker. In the usual way, and especially appropriately because the timings are so tight this evening, we won't be subjecting the lecturer to formal interrogation. But there will be, as always, a chance for informal conversation with all three of our project co-directors and also other people associated with the project over a glass of wine immediately after the lecture. So at this stage, without further ado, I'd like to invite Professor Emsley to say something. Thank you.
Thank you, David. When you live with something for a very long time, you tend to think that other people know it, perhaps not quite as well as you know it, but at least that they know it. I first used the Old Bailey Sessions papers around about the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, and I made use of them in a book. About 10 years later, when the book came out in a second edition, I was asked to review a research grant bid by one of the big research funders on the history of crime. And the applicant confidently wrote, "Unfortunately, other than newspapers, there are no recorded trial proceedings for the late 18th and 19th centuries." I'm afraid it was a case of candidate nul point. This evening we can celebrate the launch of the second tranche of the Old Bailey Proceedings Online. Now, surprisingly, some historians, some social historians of the 18th century still don't know about the resource that became available in 2003. And in spite of our valiant efforts at playing Z-list celebs, touring the radio and TV studios and giving interviews to the press, or possibly because of these efforts, it seems that there are still people who don't know about this fantastic resource. That's what you get when you log on to the website. A fantastic website of nearly, well, I suppose quoting from someone who appeared at the Old Bailey in the early 1960s, he would say that, wouldn't he? Nearly 200,000 trials covering nearly 240 years. As you can see on the top of the homepage, you can search about the proceedings, about the historical background, about the project itself. But the trials are fully searchable by name of the offender, by offence, by punishment, by year, and so on. Now, When people think of crime, they always tend to think of the spectacular, of murders, of bank robberies, of muggings. Now, you might think I'm being anachronistic using the term mugging, but if you search the Old Bailey website and look in particularly November 1862 at a street robbery trial, you'll see a police officer saying, well, of course, the locals in the St Giles Rookery area don't talk about street robbery, they don't talk about garrotting, they talk about mugging. One of the things that you can do from the Old Bailey website, I'll come back to that. People think about the enormous, the spectacular crime, rather like this one, a treason offence from 1842, an attempt on the life of Queen Victoria. There aren't many such major offences. Crime is usually much more run-of-the-mill. And that is the original from the Old Bailey, the pages of the proceedings of the Old Bailey, which we've morphed into the website. Now, I am the most IT illiterate of the co-directors, which is probably why they invited me to do this bit. I cannot go into the details, and I'm sure you wouldn't want me to go into the details, of how these originals were transformed into the online facility that we have. But at this point, I must single out a string of individuals and organisations which this entire project depends on, depended upon, and would have got nowhere without. First of all, obviously thanks to the Arts and Humanities Research Council, who provided the money. Thanks to Mark Hadley, who redesigned the website. You'll see the original version of the website, I think, later. But Mark Hadley redesigned it to the rather sharp, impressive image that you get today. I need to thank, this is a bit like the I suppose the award of an Oscar, but really I have to run through these people because what they have done has been absolutely tremendous. Heads at the University of Hertfordshire, who specifically started the morphing process, and specifically Ian Brearley, Jeff Clayton and Asif Mohammed Farouk. We need to thank also people like Mary Clayton, who put together all of the ordinary's accounts that can be cross-searched with the proceedings. Now, the ordinary was the clergyman who accompanied the condemned to the scaffold and in fine 18th century style profited from this by writing cautionary tales of the accused's careers, which he then profitably sold for the vicarious delight of 18th century readers. Now, the problem arises with the fact that some of the names on the ordinary's account are not quite the same as the names of the accused and the condemned at the Old Bailey. Now, that's one of the things that has to be sorted out. Once material is digitised, it has to be checked and marked up so that the names, offences and various other types of information can be searched and analysed by end users. A string of data developers did this for us, slaving away daily over their PCs like 19th century convicts picking oakum in their cells, and doubtless thinking that the meagre pittance they received was insufficient and looking forward to being liberated from their tasks. I can see them all smiling down here. So thanks to Gwen Smithson, who worked on both sections of the project starting in 2001, to Nikki Wilcox, Anna Bayman, Anna Simmons, Carol Lewis Roylance, Eli Garrett, Catherine Wright and Sue Parkinson. In Sheffield, we have to thank Sharon Howard and Philippa Hardman, who managed the day-to-day running of the project. Sharon and Philippa are based in the HRI, which is kindly hosting this event. So thanks to David Shepherd, the current director, and to Mark Greengrass, the previous director, who was largely responsible for overseeing the original development of the project, and which was, at the turn of the millennium, highly innovative. I think it's still highly innovative. Further thanks have to go to the HRI, not only for hosting this event, and thanks to Julie Bannum for doing that, but also for hosting the project itself. A website might seem to exist out there in the ether, but in fact it has to have a solid home, and the HRI gives it one. And finally, but by no means least, there's the HRI's technical staff. The people who can converse in a language that, unfortunately, and it's my fault, I don't understand at all. Thanks to Jamie McLaughlin, who was responsible for the search engine, and to Ed McKenzie and Kathy Rogers, who developed and constructed the automated tagging system. Now, those thank yous are far too short, far too insufficient. They should give an idea of the tremendous team effort behind this site. I think, I'm sure Bob and Tim agree with me, that they give insufficient recognition of our gratitude, just to, for me to stand up and name these people and thank them for what they allow us to do and for what they are going to allow thousands, actually tens of thousands, if you're looking at the hits on that site, tens of thousands of people to do. Now, I've already outlined the site, and as you could see from the search homepage, there are a variety of options available. Let me very quickly shoot through some of the things that can be done. That, I suppose, one of the earliest Polish migrants to this country, Sir Leon Radziniewicz, who plumbed the depths of English crime in the 18th and 19th centuries to write a history of the English criminal law, begins one of his five volumes by quoting a Frenchman in London in the 1720s. Mon Dieu, how can one expect order amongst these people who have not such a word as police in their language? Now, in many ways, this Frenchman, probably a mythical Frenchman, was right about the word police, which was commonly used in France and Germany in the 17th and 18th centuries to refer to the maintenance of order, security and welfare, generally in an urban setting. You can search for keywords, and keywords such as police. And then you can see the development of the institution. By the late 18th century, and that's really by item three here, you can see officers of the police, with police being used to define some kind of institution. As I noted at the outset, we've provided some historical background on London, the Old Bailey Court, on punishments, on the publication itself, and as you can see here, on developments of policing across the period of the printed proceedings. For any, basically anyone who is not using the resource in the kind of boring academic way that we might use it. There are a variety of features to the site. I don't have time to go through all of them. I've already mentioned the way that it's possible to search for individuals and keywords. But many of the questions that people pose about crime today and about the history of crime are quantifiable. How much of it is there? How have certain offences changed through time and so forth? Now, many history students, and unfortunately some of their teachers, tend to teeter on the brink of incontinence when asked to deal with statistics. Oh, but that's maths. Yes, it is maths. But on this site, there is the facility for doing a bit of maths, for doing a bit of statistics. As you can see here, with this basic tabulation for the category of murder, from the early 18th century to the early 19th century. The problem, of course, is that you have to take account of the shifting understanding of the word murder and its various synonyms. And of course, you can do that through other aspects of the website. The term murder does change. The way it is prosecuted also changes. Now, no single source will answer every question for a historian. The Old Bailey Online is no different, but it is a fantastic resource. It enables you to do things that basically you couldn't do before. And to address issues that you didn't think you could usefully address before. Very quickly, two examples from my own work on 19th century policing. Charles Dickens wrote about George Frederick Field, an inspector of the Metropolitan Police. And Field is generally quoted in scores of history books as being the model detective policeman. If you search for Inspector George Frederick Field on the Old Bailey website, you'll find about three references to him. He doesn't actually turn up that often. But if you type in Inspector Field, what is very interesting is you turn up an Inspector John Field. And Inspector John Field turns up at virtually every sessions from the late 1830s to the late 1840s. Inspector John Field, however, is not a metropolitan policeman. He's the inspector of the Mint, who is prosecuting people for coinage offences. Now, I'm not sure that anyone has actually recognised the scale of coinage offending in that period. Someone that I came across by accident, and having spoken to people who've worked on coinage, they haven't heard of him either. And a wonderful bent copper, or in fact two bent coppers. One of them, Charles King, who had clearly read Dickens' Oliver Twist and fancied himself as a kind of Fagin, who was prosecuted in 1855 for running a clutch of young pickpockets. Now, they got P.C. Charles King. They didn't get P.C. Charles King's mate, Jesse Jeeps. Jesse Jeeps, known in the criminal fraternity as Juicy Lips, he was hauled before the commissioner, but they didn't have enough evidence. Now, these were the days when people, if they didn't have enough evidence, could kick you out. So they kicked him out. If you look for Jesse Jeeps in the Old Bailey online, this is a man who turns up a dozen times, a simple constable from 1840 to 1855, 12 prosecutions at the Old Bailey. It rather suggests that Juicy Lips was a bit like Jonathan Wild, the great fitter-upper of the early 18th century. It's a very exciting website. I could bore for England on this website. I will now shut up and hand over to Tim Hitchcock. Thank you very much for your time.
Good evening. When in 1999, Bob Shoemaker and I sat in what was then the new British Library, first discussed the possibility of creating an online edition of the proceedings, it seemed to us a very good idea. From conception, to getting the money, to the hard slog of digitization, to the equally hard slog of tagging and preparation, to the second tranche in partnership with Clive Emsley and the Open University, to the ever-invented crisis of implementation, to the whirlwind of publicity, and the equally chaotic whirlwind of online delivery. I still think it was a good idea. But along the way, it has also become something rather better than the idea we started with. In some ways, even the present online edition of the proceedings
the people in this room have done so much to make a reality, is an extension of an essentially Enlightenment notion of knowledge and publication. It's a massive 120 million word serial body of text, indexed and structured, huge in its compass, but essentially recognizable to any historian who cut their teeth on the old Times index, or who built upper body strength hefting the catalogs in the old round reading room. As a result, in its current form, the proceedings are a beautiful culmination of what I think of as an old-fashioned idea. Perhaps, ironically, they are just so last century. But from that starting point, something else has emerged. The promise of online, searchable, mash-upable, analyzable, deracinated text is that it offers the opportunity to do something not just better, but to do something different. We have yet to see the first volume of 21st century history. We've yet to see the first bit of history that is enabled by the resources that are available on the internet. We have yet to see the first major piece of historical writing that could only be conceived as a result of the existence of online resources. But it is the promise that such a new historical form might be created that's now driving the evolution of the website, driving the evolution of the projects associated with it. Through the ESRC-funded Plebeian Lives and the Making of Modern London project, which we've spent the last 3 years helping to make happen, and will spend the next 2 years bringing to some kind of fruition, we're taking the scripts of criminality, the events of a trial, or the retrospective biography of an ordinary's account, the things that we have, and adding to them 40 million manuscript words of the scripts of both poverty and just plain normality. This is, if you like, a new Old Bailey on steroids, and will encompass 8 coherent manuscript archives. It'll encompass the records of St. Thomas's Hospital, the coroner's inquests for Westminster, the parish records of St. Clement's Danes, St. Dionys Back Church, and St. Baltoff Aldgate, and the records of the Middlesex Bench, pauper examinations and depositions, account books, and a massive archive of rotting quotidian paper. And to this, it'll add the electronic leavings deposited by a generation of historians in the Arts and Humanities Digitization Service, the Canterbury Wills, the voting records of Westminster, the hearth tax returns. And to this, too, the death and marriage and birth registers created by shoals of family historians and published as CDs. No one, anywhere, has ever attempted to digitize manuscript materials of this complexity before on this scale. And more importantly, no one has ever managed to order the vast, complex legacy of ill-digested record-keeping into a single searchable thing. In undertaking this new project, this extension to the Old Bailey, we're building on the skills created in the long process of making the Old Bailey itself happen. Without the world-beating experience built up by the Higher Education Digitization Service in double-entry rekeying, in creating usable transcripts of every kind of 18th century hand imaginable, and there are more 18th century hands than I can imagine, we couldn't do this project without the expertise of Jamie McLaughlin, without his experience of designing search facilities and making them work. We couldn't do this project without Sharon Howard's management and technical skills and simple commitment. We couldn't do this project without Ed McKenzie and Kathy Rogers, without Philippa Hardman and the HRI. We couldn't do this project. In other words, we have taken a body of expertise built up across almost a decade between three universities and reimagined what could be done and turned it into a new and complex purpose. The really new thing about this project, of the new project, of Plebeian Lives, is that it relies for its very sense on the ability of search engines to find a single word in a sea of text. If we could not sift these sands of time for historical meaning at the click of a mouse, there would be no point in digitizing these archives. Better to leave them in their original form. But if we can search them, analyze them, link them across the archival spaces that have hitherto been unbridgeable, We as historians can move beyond scripts that retell limited stories of admittedly gripping and dramatic events created essentially for an 18th or 19th century audience, to telling life scripts, to building lifelines that snake through the archives, to evidence each interaction between a beggar or a criminal or just a person, and the systems on which they relied or feared or avoided, to map a collection of lives. The Old Bailey proceedings were a good idea because they brought into the digital age the single most important and classic source for history from below, with that humane tradition of writing from the bottom up and from a single individual's perspective. The point is now to move beyond that tradition to what is only now conceivable. In my own mind, this amounts to adding a collective rigor to the humane narratives of history from below, too, if you'll excuse a historiographical reference, forcing Raphael Samuel to sit down with Louis Namur and then figuring out what they might together have said to Karl Marx. In the process, what the project seeks to achieve is a new way of understanding how individual decisions made by non-elite men and women contributed to the evolution of the institutions of modernity, of hospitals and workhouses, prisons, courtrooms, and local government. And I'll do so by tracing people's lives through this massive archive. And in the process, we'll argue that the agency deployed by working people, the decisions they made in difficult circumstances, helped to explain why and how things changed, both in the past and by extension in the present. But more than a new intellectual aspiration, a new explanation of historical change, this project is also about recognizing that the audience we as academics need to reach is different than it once was. The point about building upwards from individual lives is it allows us to connect in ways that most historians cannot, to the greatest body of readers and historical researchers ever, to the family historians. And it's not 10,000 users, but 10 million users who have made use of this website. By making this project about lives, we generate something that they want to read at the same time as we analyze something that we want to explain. And as the tools of social software gain a new maturity, as Sharon Howard adds a wiki to the Old Bailey site, as we create facilities for our users to provide new content, as data mining and the searching of distant distributed resources become more achievable, a growing and organic intellectual project is gradually being brought into existence. It will have its monographs, articles, and its authors, but it will also have its blogs and mashups and its communities of users. In the process, it will tie the unbounded historical interest in the everyday to the intellectual exercise of academic history and create the infrastructure that allows us to communicate beyond the academy. Essentially, and in other words, what began as an attempt to make a humane individual history from below easier to research and to write has become an attempt to add a new layer to that tradition, to update it in light of the full promise of digital resources, and to make it fit for the politics of today. The project is now about rediscovering the magical combination of narrative and individuals and politics that characterized the best progressive histories of the 1960s and 70s, and adding to those the magic of digitization and the internet and turning the whole to a new purpose. One of the great arts of academic life is to trust that an interesting, important conclusion will emerge at the end of a project, will present itself at the end of 5 or 10 or 20 years of hard slog, and that it will be important even if it turns out to bear little relationship to the question with which you began. I still like to think that the idea with which we started was a good one, but I have to admit that it has become a shed load better and more interesting along the way. Thank you.
Thank you, Clive. Thank you, Tim, for that wonderful overview of past, present, and future of all the questions that are raised by this project. Well, now to the introduction of our lecturer this evening. Bob Shoemaker joined the University of Sheffield in 1991, following a number of posts at several institutions, including Stanford University, where he completed his AM in 1980 and PhD in 1985, having graduated from Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1978. Promotion to senior lecturer in 1998 was followed by conferment of the rank of reader in 2002, and then elevation to the professorial ranks in 2003. The next year came headship of the Department of History. I believe this is known as night following day, for a four-year sentence that will end in August. Throughout his career, Bob Shoemaker has been an astonishingly productive scholar. His first book, Prosecution and Punishment, Petty Crime and the Law in London and Rural Middlesex, appeared with Cambridge University Press in 1991. In 1998, Longman brought us Gender in English Society, 1650 to 1850. In the same year, he co-edited with his Sheffield colleague Mary Vincent a reader on gender and history in Western Europe. The title of Bob's third monograph, The London Mob, Violence and Disorder in 18th Century England, published by Hamilton and London in 2004, might seem to suggest a return to earlier concerns. In fact, it signals the persistence of a sustained preoccupation with questions of crime and disorder, to which, apart from the Old Bailey website, of course, the titles of many of Bob's numerous articles and book chapters also bear witness. The most recent testimony in book form to this preoccupation came in late 2006, when this, Tales from the Hanging Court, written jointly with Tim Hitchcock and offering a selection from the digitised Old Bailey proceedings, emerged just in time for Christmas. Now, it's at this point that I usually try to spice up the roster of academic honours with something a little bit more personal about our lecturer. So it'll come as no surprise to you that in my quest to add depth to my sketch of Bob Shoemaker, historian of crime and violence, I had instant recourse to that resource that he and his collaborators have created, to see whether there might be anything incriminating at all in a distant past to which some link, however tenuous, might be established. A keyword search on Shoemaker produces a promising total of 3,370 hits. Most of these appear to be cobblers. A search on the surname Shoemaker turns up just one case. On the 11th of January 1717, Jacob Shoemaker of London was indicted for endeavouring to defraud one William Brind of 30 shillings by pawning a brass cup washed with silver as a silver one, avouching of it to be sterling, a misdemeanour for which he was fined 10 marks and sentenced to 3 months' imprisonment. Might there be a relationship here? Could those 300-year-old hoodwinking skills have been transmuted over generations into, for example, masterful presentation of an RAE narrative, or perhaps of a strategic plan for the Academic Development Committee? Surely not. So, precious little incriminating evidence in the Old Bailey proceedings. But of course, we all know the limits of online resources, glorious though they be. Oral history can sometimes be a surer bet. So, of course, I turned to sources that I knew to be impeccable. Let me now, belatedly but no less warmly for that, welcome Bob's wife, Wendy Bracewell, and their son, Roland, to this evening's lecture. It's great to see you here. At another event here in the HRI a couple of weeks ago, I asked Wendy if she might dig up something scurrilous on her other half. Silence ensued, but then came an obliging email last week. The beginning is unpromising, boilerplate stuff about a model parent, loving son, ideal husband, etc., etc. Those are Wendy's, etc. But then comes the bombshell. It is at this point that I am able to reveal that our lecturer this evening, Professor Robert Brink Shoemaker, does indeed have, in addition to his distinguished record as a historian of crime, something approximating to a criminal record. At the age of 16, Bob was stopped by police and given a ticket for running a stop sign in Corvallis, Oregon, on his bicycle. Not one to take this kind of affront lying down, he appealed, pleading extenuating circumstances. He was going too fast down a steep hill for it to be safe to stop. Always a man in a hurry. The judge harumphed, I quote from Wendy again, and imposed a reduced fine. No doubt, Bob, had somebody actually been killed as a result of your reckless riding, even at that tender age, you'd have argued that the incident should be adjudged chance medley. Was this brush with the law perhaps a life-changing moment for a young man who, until then, had had ambitions to be an architect, I gather? Could it be said of Bob Shoemaker, and I hope you'll forgive my digressing into my own disciplinary expertise or specialism here of Russian literature, could it be said of Bob Shoemaker, as Dostoevsky's narrator in Crime and Punishment says of Raskolnikov, exiled to Siberia for the admittedly more serious crime of double murder, here begins a new story, the story of an individual's gradual renewal, of his gradual rebirth, of his acquaintance with a hitherto unknown reality. Is a glittering career as historian of crime in some way expiation of that youthful misdemeanour? If so, then perhaps an inaugural lecture might be seen as a form of required community service. In any event, let us celebrate the fact that Bob Shoemaker did choose the path of historian, and that this evening it will be our privilege to hear him speak to us on what is, beyond any doubt, his very own specialist subject, learning about crime. Professor Shoemaker.
Thank you very much, David. And you were too kind to make the point that this lecture is, of course, long overdue. If you listen carefully to the chronology, I've been a professor for quite some time. But one or two responsibilities have, of course, gotten in the way of my research over the past 4 years. I'm grateful to David and to you for putting up with such a late inaugural. And it is, of course, entirely appropriate for this lecture to be linked to the launch of the Old Bailey website and for it to take place in the HRI, the home of the Old Bailey Project, over the past 7 years. The many people who have contributed to this project over this long period have already been thanked, not only those in Sheffield, but also at Hertfordshire and the Open University. But I must mention two more, the two gentlemen who are sitting in front of me. The first is Tim Hitchcock, who I freely admit first came up with the idea of putting the Old Bailey trial accounts online during that conversation in the British over a cup of coffee in the British Library in 1999. I feel extremely fortunate to have been able to work so closely with a man who's not only a continuous fount of ideas and arguments, but also is a longtime friend. The second is Clive Emsley, who joined Tim and me as a director of the Old Bailey Online project at the start of the 1834 to 1913 phase, and who fit in perfectly. I'm grateful to Clive for his contributions of equal measures of expertise, good judgment, and wit to our project meetings. Now, as many of you no doubt expect, there's a double meaning to my title today, a historiographical focus on how historians have addressed this subject and how particularly my own approach has changed over the years, and a historical question about how individuals have learned about crime in the past. My starting premise is that people learn more about crime through indirect sources, such as the media, than from personal experience. Fortunately, at a personal level, I was going to say my own experience of crime as a perpetrator is limited, but I've been exposed here. But both as victim and perpetrator, you'll be glad to hear I have a limited experience of crime. But some colleagues will be aware of the break into my office a few weeks ago. My own family, and I'm very pleased that Andy and Roland are here tonight, as well as colleagues, will no doubt confirm that I'm nonetheless almost paranoid in my obsession with keeping doors and windows locked and setting alarms. So where do my fears come from? Obviously, at least in part, from the media. Since the late 17th century, if not earlier, people in this country have learned more about crime from what they read than from their own experiences. And what they have read has been distorted in various ways and imbued with ideological messages. My own scholarly interest in the subject of crime developed in the 1970s, when, as an undergraduate student at Reed College in the West Coast American city of Portland, Oregon, I read the works of Edward Thompson, Douglas Hay, and the other British Marxist historians, and I studied popular protest and the emergence of class conflict in 18th century England. I was no Anglophile. My interest in this subject was a theoretical interest in the connection... My interest in this subject was a theoretical interest in the connection between deviance and the emergence of class consciousness in an industrializing society. When I began my PhD research at Stanford University, I decided to study petty crime in London, because this topic allowed me to look at the almost daily practice of popular protest on the streets of a fast-expanding metropolis. But the more I worked on this topic, the more I realized that the data I was gathering from the Court of Sessions records was not telling me very much about petty crime, since it became obvious that only a very small proportion of petty crimes were ever prosecuted. The discretionary nature of the English judicial system, with its reliance on private citizens to report crimes and apprehend suspected criminals, meant that most crimes, particularly petty crimes, were never reported. Victims had a variety of other informal methods for dealing with the culprits. My topic became instead the question of how crime was prosecuted, and I considered what this could tell us about both popular and elite attitudes toward the law at this time. And this led to the publication of Prosecution and Punishment, my first book, which David mentioned, a book which amazingly, due to the wonders of modern digital publishing, has just been reissued. This is, in fact, this concentration on the prosecution of crime is, in fact, where the historiography of crime had moved to in the 1980s and 1990s. As historians like Peter King, John Beatty, and John Langbein studied the discretionary application of the law and charted developments in policing, punishment, and the evolution of the criminal trial. Attempts by Marxist historians such as Peter Linebaugh to study crime as a form of working class protest were largely discredited by historians, though they did attract a wider audience, and Beatty's heroic attempt, along with Douglas Hay, to argue that patterns of prosecutions of theft reflected real changes in the incidence of theft over time, were abandoned. Instead, we learned a lot about the origins of modern policing and the origins of the modern policing and criminal justice systems. These were important subjects, but crime itself largely ceased to be investigated. Perhaps for this reason, around this time, I temporarily lost interest in the subject and moved into the study of gender. By this time, I joined the Sheffield History Department and developed a fruitful collaboration with Mary Vincent, teaching a course on gender, the first ever offered in the department. And it led to the publication of the two books on gender, which David mentioned. Now, gender is not the subject of this lecture, but I mention this aspect of my work because it's a nice example of how much I've gained from working with my colleagues in the history department. And it shows the synergies between research and teaching, which are possible here at Sheffield. For a number of reasons, gender was a useful intellectual diversion for me, not least because it directed me into cultural history, a topic my graduate training in the late 70s and early 1980s had largely ignored. I began to see that representations of behavior were an important dimension of any analysis of social practices, not only because they're a fundamental aspect of the sources we use to study them, but also because social behavior itself was shaped by and acquired meanings from such constructions. I still remained committed to the study of social practice, but I came to recognize the importance of representations in understanding its significance. Now, because time is limited, I'll fast forward past my London Mob book to the Old Bailey Online, a project which I originally viewed as a nice little sideline, separate from my other research interests, especially as its focus on serious crime was different from my earlier... I've just screwed it up. and they think I'm IT literate. Thank you. Yeah.
Is it this
right one or...
Oh, all right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, you've seen that.
So we come on... So my point here is that despite my thinking that initially the Old Bailey Online project wasn't going to be the major focus of my research, over the past few years, in a process somewhat similar to what Tim has described, the project has had an insidious way of worming itself into the very core of my research. This is the first edition of the Old Bailey website, something we can now get nostalgic about. Having inflicted the proceedings onto the world, selling them largely as a valuable window into the lives of ordinary people, and not specifically as a source about crime and justice, I felt it was necessary to investigate the accuracy of this publication as a source. So I began to compare the trial accounts with other printed and manuscript sources of the same trials where they survived, and I discovered some significant discrepancies, particularly in terms of the material that had been left out of the proceedings. I came to the conclusion that the Old Bailey proceedings presented a particular account of crime and criminal justice to their readers, one which both emphasized the severity of the crime problem and provided reassurance that the courts were able to respond to it. The results of this research were first published as a page on the Old Bailey website, and this is the current version of that page. Now, this research begged the question of what readers actually concluded from reading the proceedings, and the larger question of how public knowledge about crime was constructed in 18th century London. My interest in this question was stimulated by the most recent book of John Beatty, the doyen of historians of 18th century crime and punishment, who argued that, prompted by public concerns about crime, the city of London played a major role in instigating innovative forms of policing and punishment in the first half of the 18th century. In the context of the unusually inclusive local governments of the city, Londoners who were worried about crime provided support and pressure for important innovations in policing and punishment in this period, notably the introduction of the salaried night watch and the introduction of punishment as a form of transportation on a systematic basis in 1718. But Beattie's argument begged the question, how did 18th century Londoners, or at least some of those who formed part of the city's remarkably participatory form of local government, come to the conclusion that crime was a significant social problem? And since not everyone shared these views, how and why did others come to different conclusions? How, in other words, did 18th century Londoners learn about crime? This is obviously not an easy question to answer, since there are a few sources which document what people actually thought about crime. Surviving diaries and correspondence, however, tell us that, as argued earlier, most people did not learn about crime from their own personal experiences, or even those of their friends and neighbors. References to crime in Londoners' diaries and correspondence from the period are relatively rare. And of the few crimes they did record, burglaries and street fights, not the robberies and murders which were the subject of so much public concern, were the most common. A similar conclusion emerges from analyzing the geographical location of the crimes prosecuted at the Old Bailey, which is one of the more innovative features of the Old Bailey website allows you to do. This is a map produced from a search on the website demonstrating the number of crimes linked to the street Drury Lane. Each dot provides access to all the crimes linked to that location, and in this case, 72 crimes are connected with Old Bailey have been located over 45 years. Even a notorious crime hotspot like Drury Lane, with its disorderly houses and brothels, was the location of, on average, only two crimes a year tried at the Old Bailey during the 18th century. And as you can see, some of the neighboring streets and alleys had none. While it is true, of course, that most crimes went unreported at this time, and in many cases the culprits were never even identified, it's nonetheless significant that so few crimes in such a disreputable neighborhood like this led to publicly reported prosecutions. Instead of through personal experience or local knowledge, or by witnessing the rituals of public executions, as was common in many early modern European cities, printed literature was the most important source of public knowledge about crime, which Londoners consumed either directly through reading or indirectly by hearing reports from other readers. Stimulated by increasing literacy among women as well as men, from the late 17th century, England, and particularly London, witnessed a huge explosion of printed literature, not just in the traditional forms of the book, pamphlet, broadside, and ballad, but also in new genres, such as the Old Bailey proceedings itself, as well as newspapers, periodicals, and the novel. The expiration of pre-publication censorship in 1695 further contributed to this explosion of print. And crime was a recurring theme in almost every form of printed literature at this time. What did they learn from this literature? First, it's worth noting something they didn't learn. They learned very little about the numbers of crimes committed or prosecuted. Before 1772, no statistics about the number of prosecutions were published. So it was the qualitative descriptions of crimes and the accumulated impact of the large numbers of individual crime reports which were important. In assessing the overall impact of these reports, we need to look at the wide range of print genres in which crime was discussed. And crucially, we need to pay attention to evidence of reader response, where such evidence survives. As today, probably the most important source of information about crime for Londoners was the daily reports of crime in the newspapers. The modern newspaper was invented in 18th century London. The first successful daily paper, the Daily Courant, began publication in 1702, and the number of newspapers published and their circulation increased dramatically during the century. While foreign news often dominated, crime was a recurrent feature of domestic reporting, perhaps because crime reports were a cheap and reliably constant source of news. These formed a major part of newspaper content. According to one estimate, 10% of the news reporting in the late 18th century concerned crime, and these reports were influential. At the start of the century, one pamphlet cited, quote, "the public news daily full of so many relations of robberies and murders," unquote, as part of its evidence that the roads had become so dangerous and unsafe. As today, newspapers presented a distorted picture of crime by paying disproportionate attention to violent crime. Occasionally, they reported general observations on the state of crime in London, as when the Whitehall Evening Post commented in 1749 during a post-war crime wave on, quote, "the frequency of audacious street robberies repeated in this great metropolis. There's no possibility of stirring from our habitations after dark without the hazard of a fractured skull." But it was the relentless daily reporting of individual crimes which probably had a bigger impact on public perceptions. These reports exaggerated levels of violence. A quarter of the crimes reported were robberies and murders, whereas they account for only 7% of the crimes tried at the Old Bailey. So as a proportion of serious crimes tried, newspapers were almost four times more likely to report violent crimes than other types of offense. In comparison, only 9% of newspaper crime reports concerned burglary and 6% concerned pickpocketing, despite the fact these were the two crimes Londoners reported most in their own personal experiences in their diaries. The author and politician Horace Walpole noted that the frequency of crime reports served to exaggerate perceptions of the problem. Walpole was robbed by the highwayman James McLean in 1749, when Walpole was slightly injured when McLean's pistol accidentally fired. But Walpole said the frequent repetition of the story in the newspapers was much worse than the robbery. Similarly, he noted that riots in the city in 1771, quote, "make less impression on the spot than by a collection of them crowded into a newspaper." Now, newspapers not only overemphasized violence and disorder by the frequency of their reports, but also with the tone and substance of their reporting. In part, this was due to practical constraints. Until the 1760s, pressures of space meant that reports tended to be very brief. Such reports inevitably tended to privilege action over motivation, which made crime seem difficult to understand and therefore more threatening. Moreover, in concise reports, the use of shorthand labels, such as highwaymen and footpads, had the effect of representing criminals as habitual and therefore more threatening criminals. But the negative language went further. Reports tended to adopt a pejorative tone, with robbers frequently labeled as rogues, ruffians, and villains, and often described as working in gangs. An evocative language was used to describe any violence committed. Readers responded to newspaper reports in a number of ways. The papers were consumed both directly through reading and indirectly through discussion of their content at coffee houses and other venues of the 18th century public sphere. In repeating their stories to their acquaintances, some readers exaggerated the violence further. When the papers reported in 1793 that the body of a Frenchman had been discovered in the Thames, by the time Mary Berry repeated the story to Horace Walpole, it had been transformed into a case of murder. Some readers were so convinced by newspapers' reports of the threat posed by violent crime that they responded by arming themselves, banding together to form prosecution societies, and when they became witnesses or victims of crime, prosecuting the culprits formally, despite the considerable costs involved. Peter King has suggested that the selective reporting of the most threatening aspects of crime in the newspapers could so successfully stimulate fears of crime that at certain times, such as the conclusions of wars when England faced the prospect of an influx of unemployed and possibly violent demobilized soldiers, they could create moral panics, leading to increased prosecutions even when crime itself was not increasing. But other readers, aware that newspapers often spread scandal in order to increase their readership, read the papers more critically. Because newspaper reporting emerged in the context of political crises and party conflict around the turn of the 18th century, Londoners treated newspapers with a degree of skepticism from the very start of the genre. Later in the century, Walpole repeatedly told his correspondents that the newspapers could not be trusted. He wrote to one that half the reports of robberies and murders in the papers were lies, though interestingly he recognized that they nonetheless fill the imagination. Walpole exaggerated for effect, but the point is important. Readers did not necessarily trust what they read in the papers. Now, as already suggested, the Old Bailey proceedings also emphasize the dangers posed by criminality, while seeking to reassure readers that the crime problem was under control. Licensed by the City of London, which kept an occasional eye on their content, the publishers had to report trials in a way that would keep the authorities happy, as well as hold on to their essentially middle-class audience. Given severe constraints on space, reports had to be selective. One typical edition at mid-century devoted not much more than half a column for each trial, despite the fact that each lasted around 20 or 30 minutes, as can be seen in this example of the trial of Samuel Cardoza for theft. It's on the on your left there. That's the full report of a trial that probably took about half an hour. Point is, these were reports, not transcripts, contrary to some press stories about the website in the last few weeks. What's significant is what got left out. Reports of the trials were edited to present a distinctive image of crime and public justice to their readers. There's not much evidence that the proceedings actually misreported what went on in the Old Bailey courtroom, though there's some. As a public space, there were too many witnesses to the events for the proceedings to be able to tell outright lies. But the story of a trial could be distinctively spun by decisions about what to include and what to leave out. In terms of the representation of crime, unsurprisingly, the proceedings, like the newspapers, focused more attention on violent crimes, while relatively mundane thefts were very briefly reported. This contributed to the popular impression that crime was a serious problem. In addition to the newspapers, the proceedings were cited by an early 18th century pamphlet as evidence that robbery and murder had become so widespread. But more importantly, the proceedings reassured readers that the courts could cope with the crime problem. Trial reports were constructed in order to present an image of justice in which criminals, who were sometimes portrayed as habitual by the use of references to their appearances in earlier trials, were shown as receiving their just deserts. Comparison with other available accounts of the same trials indicates that several aspects of the criminal trial were often either omitted or severely pruned in the published proceedings so that they could make this point. The omissions include procedural matters, such as the participation of lawyers, evidence of jury decision-making, and the judge's summing up. This had the effect of presenting trials as a direct confrontation between the victim and the accused, with no distracting interventions by lawyers to muddy the waters, and thus no suggestion that the verdict was a result of technicalities or arguments introduced by lawyers. Verdicts were presented as a direct result of the facts produced by the witnesses. Justice was presented as unproblematic and in a coherent narrative form. But the representation of this contest between prosecution and defendant was not evenly reported. While both were edited, more of the defense case was omitted, leaving readers with an account of the case which made the defendant appear more certainly guilty of the crime in print than he had appeared actually in the courtroom. And the conviction of the guilty is what was emphasized. Far less space was devoted to trials resulting in acquittals than to those resulting in convictions. However, the proceedings also sought to convey the message that trials at the Old Bailey were conducted fairly. This meant that the proceedings did normally present both sides of the story. The defense case was usually reported, however briefly. This means that the proceedings provided a rare opportunity for the voices of accused criminals to be presented in print, in however attenuated and edited a form that might be, in contrast to the newspaper's almost exclusive focus on reports by victims and the authorities. For example, female thieves, whose voices were rarely reported in any other form of print, had their defense testimonies reported in the proceedings, providing reading audiences with a set of representations of female criminality found in few other publications. One notable exception is of course, Daniel Defoe's novel Moll Flanders, published in 1722, which itself is arguably influenced by the stories found in the proceedings. Thus, women accused of theft explained in the proceedings in terms which were often quite plausible, how they stole out of economic necessity, or how they happened to be found in possession of allegedly stolen goods in ways which rendered their guilt questionable. Sometimes they explained that they had been given or borrowed the goods, or more often they claimed that the goods had been given to them in payment for sexual services rendered, or alternatively, that the prosecution was maliciously motivated because they had refused to have sex with the prosecutor. Because the proceedings had to present both sides of the story, however much the publisher wanted to send a message that crime didn't pay, these trial reports possessed what one literary critic has described as a resistance to closure. How did contemporaries read the proceedings? There is evidence that many readers accepted them as authoritative, but others pointed out their limitations. Some readers published pamphlets complaining about the partial or distorted nature of specific trial reports in the proceedings, usually inadequate reporting of the case for the defense. And such complaints were also occasionally published in periodicals and newspapers. At the conclusion of his term of office as Lord Mayor in November 1775, John Wilkes complained bitterly of the inadequate reporting in the proceedings, which he said, quote, had been long and universally complained of, unquote. At least some readers will have been aware of these limitations, of these complaints, and of the competing publications which provided alternative accounts of some trials. And they will have read the picture of crime and justice presented in the proceedings with some skepticism. Other readers, including suspected criminals, used the proceedings tactically, quoting from previous editions in their courtroom testimony in order to discredit witnesses who testified against them. Now, the point of the accused was even more apparent in the proceedings' sister publication, known as the Ordinaries Accounts, which Clive has already explained are also now available on the website. Part of a wider trend of the development of autobiographical narratives and increased recognition of individual subjectivity in this period, Ordinaries Accounts provided life stories and the last dying speeches of executed felons. The Ordinaries, Clive explained, was the chaplain of Newgate Prison, and his job was to counsel the prisoners awaiting their punishment, and by encouraging them to reflect on their sins, prepare them to meet their maker. As a profitable sideline, he was allowed to publish accounts of these criminals' lives in the last days and minutes before their executions. And this is a genre we can actually trace back to John Fox's Book of Martyrs. The Ordinaries had an ideological agenda. Their accounts of the lives and behavior of those condemned to hang were molded in order to show prisoners, with the help of the ordinary, coming to terms with their sinful past, confessing their crimes, and preparing for a Christian death. The message of the reading public was clearly to demonstrate the wages of sin and the dangers to which everyone, regardless of social class, was susceptible. If you engage in any form of vice, you will be stepping onto a slippery slope which could well land you eventually at the gallows, something I hope you remember when you pick up that second glass of wine this evening. Despite this common narrative framework, what's impressive about the Ordinaries' accounts is the opportunities they gave to convicted felons to shape their life stories in ways which often subverted the post-trial script of confession and repentance. By allowing convicts to tell their own life stories and present their versions of the events surrounding their crimes, the accounts gave a voice to the condemned. While the Ordinaries sometimes criticized and sarcastically commented on these stories, they nonetheless included them, because that's what readers wanted. The views of men and women facing imminent death were thought to be particularly truthful at this time. In telling their stories, convicts were able to introduce mitigating factors in justification of their crimes, while always, of course, acknowledging their general sinfulness and sincere repentance. This was even true in the case of Catherine Hayes, who was convicted with two men in 1726 of the gruesome murder of her husband, followed by cutting up the body and secretly disposing of the pieces. Unsurprisingly, this sensational case was the subject of several publications, many of which portrayed Hayes as the typical female villain, who had an ungovernable temper and loose morals, and who had not only instigated the crime, as is pretty clear in this image, and the cover-up, but had committed adultery with one of her husband's killers, Thomas Billings, who, to make the story even worse, was, according to some reports, her illegitimate son. Despite the horrific crime and the allegations of adultery and incest, the Ordinary reported Hayes's side of the story, which was that her husband had mistreated her by not allowing her to go to church and had beat her, sometimes breaking her ribs and bones, and that he had killed two newborn children of hers and buried them under some fruit trees. In modern language, she was a battered wife. She claimed she'd been unaware of the two men's plans for the murder and that she'd been in the next room when the crime took place, and she justified her participation in the cover-up by his mistreatment of her. Now, the Ordinary treated all these claims skeptically, comparing them to the contradictory testimonies of her accomplices. Yet, he reported them. And in concluding his report, and here's the passage reproduced on the Old Bailey website, he said more positively that, quote, she seemed to be a woman of good natural parts, but grossly ignorant in religious matters, unquote. And he repeated her claim that, quote, she had been just and upright in her dealings, charitable to the poor, careful in household affairs, and faithful and dutiful to her husband. Now, these are extraordinary things to say about a woman who's been convicted of a brutal, cold-blooded murder. Ultimately, readers who encountered a much more negative picture of Hayes in the newspapers and other printed accounts were left to draw their own conclusions. And I should point out here that readers could be quite skeptical or quite critical of the Ordinary's accounts. But the point here is that the Ordinary presented her side of the story. This fascinating genre demonstrates, even more than its sister publication, The Proceedings, that representations of individual criminals in some print genres were far from the largely one-dimensional images found in the newspapers. By providing some accounts, however mediated from the point of view of the accused, these publications gave readers understandable explanations of why crimes were committed and why some of the accused may actually have been innocent. The heavy public demand for information about criminal lives led to the publication of numerous other criminal biographies. Desperate for copy, hack writers canvassed the prisoners in Newgate Prison, looking for authentic, suitable stories, which they published with advertisements that the material was taken from the mouth of, or taken from the mouth of the criminal, or from papers of his own writing. Some of these biographies presented even more sympathetic images of criminality to their readers, presenting their subjects as heroic figures, free from the shackles of social convention, who are sometimes celebrated as social and political critics. And this was particularly true in the case of highway robbery. Take the case of James McLean, who, together with his partner William Plunkett, was active on the roads around London in 1749 and 1750, and who used the proceeds of his crimes to live an opulent, gentlemanly lifestyle in the fashionable St. James's district of the metropolis, socializing with the very types of people who were his victims. His arrest and trial in the summer of 1750 excited huge public interest. Following the arrest, Walpole noted that, quote, there are as many prints and pamphlets about McLean as the earthquake, which had recently occurred in London. These publications adopted a variety of perspectives. The account of his trial and the proceedings suggests nothing very chivalrous or gentlemanly about his crimes. He and Plunkett were reported as threatening to blow the brains out of one of the victims who had concealed some of his money. And showing less sympathy than usual, the Ordinary of Newgate was skeptical of McLean's claims to gentility. On the other hand, some of the other biographies presented a more positive view of McLean, labeling him the gentleman highwayman. Relying at least in part on circumstantial details and justifications which were clearly provided by McLean himself, these presented an ambivalent picture of McLean as a tragic character with a good heart, but who had a fatal love of pleasure and ambition to live above his station. This biography reported in admiring tones that robbers like McLean, quote, had some claim to what we call in this country a gentleman. They have gained more honor by going to the gallows than they could have attained by an age of industry. Moreover, McLean and Plunkett's crimes were described as involving polite and chivalrous behavior. In one, Plunkett supposedly put his pistol in his pocket, quote, for fear of frightening the ladies, and without forcing a lady out of the coach, took what small matter she offered without further search, unquote. Before riding off with their loot, they bid a polite adieu to the passengers. Referring to the corrupt Whig oligarchy of the time, another biography provided a political justification for their crimes by reporting Plunkett's statement to a victim, quote, that they did not rob through wantonness, as the great ones did, who daily rob them of millions for the support of luxury and corruption, but they were forced to do it for their immediate subsistence. Concurrently, several prints of MacLean were sold, depicting him as a gentleman, including this one, the lady's hero of the unfortunate James MacLean Esquire. Apparently, this was based on a drawing of MacLean made while he was in prison, and one can just imagine him posing in his cell. He appears, obviously, here as a gentleman, and note, of course, the suffix Esquire, and with the accoutrements of gentility, a sword. The only indication of his deviant profession is the Venetian mask lying on the ground beside him, which ambiguously was used both by highway robbers and by elites attending masquerades, which were fashionable at the time. Now, these positive, if by no means entirely uncritical, representations of highway robbery were no doubt read skeptically. Walpole purchased 3 pamphlets about MacLean, but perhaps as a result of his own experience as one of MacLean's victims the previous year, he was not seduced by the fashion of celebrating him as a gentleman highwayman. As he commented, "His profession is no joke." Nonetheless, it's remarkable that such pamphlets were published at all in 1750, at a time of considerable public concern about crime, following the demobilization of military forces at the end of the War of Austrian Succession. Only a year later, Henry Fielding would publish his inquiry into the late increase of robbers, with its no-holds-barred account of the threat robbers posed to the safety of the nation, not least by those like MacLean, who were motivated by the pursuit of luxury. Despite the unpromising context, MacLean the highway robber was depicted in some biographies as a heroic figure. And some Londoners responded positively, treating MacLean as a celebrity. He was visited in Newgate Prison by several gentlemen and ladies, many of whom gave him financial assistance. And the Sunday following his conviction, reportedly 3,000 people went to see him in his cell. He was even the subject of petitions to the king demanding a pardon. So, 18th century Londoners encountered remarkably diverse representations of serious crime in their reading. There was no single hegemonic message of crime control disseminated in print culture. While the predominant tone, found in the genres published most frequently, newspapers and the proceedings, represented crime as a violent and threatening problem, while depicting the courts as largely successfully addressing the issue, trial reports presented 2 sides of the story, however briefly. And since this was a time when the public was keen to know more about the lives of individual criminals, whether for purposes of entertainment, instruction, or social criticism, other printed publications provided more detailed accounts from the point of view of the accused, with material often provided by the culprits themselves. Like the satirical prints of William Hogarth, then, the messages of the printed literature of crime were ambiguous. In this print, Plate 3 of Industry and Idleness, for example, the blame for Tom Idle's descent into criminality is not placed solely on Tom. Print culture did not disseminate a single negative image of crime and its causes, though through frequent coverage it repeatedly called attention to the problem, and by doing so, exaggerated its significance. The contradictory images found in printed representations of crime facilitated a debate, at least implicitly. So what did readers conclude from these often contradictory accounts? This is, of course, a difficult question, and one which cries out for further investigation, despite the limited sources available. But the evidence I've uncovered so far suggests that Londoners read all of this literature, including the official accounts, with a skeptical eye. At least some were aware of the ulterior motives which shaped particular ways in which authors represented crime, whether as entertainment, threat, or moral lesson, and they were prepared to dismiss accounts which they thought were unreliable. As the evidence of highway robbery suggests, in certain circumstances, Londoners were willing to respond sympathetically to the justifications offered by criminals for their crimes. These conclusions form a vital and underappreciated context for understanding 18th century debates about crime and penal and judicial reform. They constitute one of the reasons why, despite frequently expressed concerns about the extent of crime and doubts about the merits of the death penalty as a primary means of dealing with it, support for both policing and penal reforms in this period was limited. In short, the reading public knew the crime problem was more complicated than reformers like Henry Fielding, with their apocalyptic complaints about the dangers of traveling the streets, made it appear. But this multivocal representation of criminality in 18th century print culture did not last. In the 1770s, the character of printed literature about crime changed significantly due to new financial and official constraints on publication and the shifting cultural preoccupations of readers. As respectable society lost interest in the life experiences of members of the deviant lower classes, as they came to see crime as less a sin to which every man was susceptible and more is a characteristic of a particular inferior class of people. The ordinary's accounts ceased publication, and criminal biographies were less frequently published. And as the proceedings came under tighter control by the City of London, they lost much of their audience due to their growing size and increased cost. Consequently, newspapers became the dominant source of public knowledge about crime. Although their coverage expanded in the late 18th century, it also became more selective, focusing primarily on crimes committed by or on apparently respectable men and women. While some forms of cheap print, such as ballads and execution broadsides, continued to be to disseminate relatively sympathetic images of the common criminal, these images largely disappeared from the literature consumed by middle and upper class readers. So the period between roughly the 1690s and the 1770s was something of a golden age of writing about crime, in which crime was a key theme in print culture, even among that consumed by elite readers. And the voices of criminals, as well as their victims, could clearly be heard. But partly, simply by sheer repetition, the victim-centered stories of violence and danger in the newspapers and Old Bailey proceedings eventually prevailed, thereby contributing to the emergence of the class divisions of the late 18th century. By the 19th century, the more uniformly negative representations of crime in print helped muster support for the establishment of the Metropolitan Police and other major judicial and penal reforms. So, via the detours of legal history, gender, and cultural history, I've come back to the study of crime. But you could say that, like many others, I'm now studying the topic in an irritatingly postmodern way, looking more at how crime was represented and argued over rather than the actual activity of crime itself. To this charge, I plead part guilty and ask the judge to take into consideration three mitigating circumstances. The first is to acknowledge that this is an inevitable problem for historians. In recent years, we have properly become much more aware of the limitations of what we can actually know about a past, which we must accept is no longer accessible to us. In the case of crime, this problem is more serious than most, since the sources are always going to be much more limited when you're studying an illegal activity primarily committed by an underclass. We must admit that we cannot know how much crime actually occurred. But then even today, a significant proportion of crimes are not reported. This does not mean we will never know anything about 18th century crime. While we certainly will not know how much crime occurred, there's much we can learn from the study of representations about the nature of criminality, including the motivations of the perpetrators. And I've outlined briefly some relevant evidence about that today. Secondly, the study of representations of crime does not simply mean we are learning only about how middle and upper class Londoners constructed crime as a social problem. As I've argued today, the criminal suspect him or herself helped shape the content of many of these publications. And we can often actually hear the voice of the criminal, in however mediated a form, in some genres. If everything that historians study is only representations, at least these representations, from a number of different subject positions, including that of the perpetrator, can give us a multidimensional perspective on that elusive topic of crime itself, demonstrating a wide range of motivations for committing crime, including social protest, which of course is the topic I started with. Finally, I never embarked on the study of crime solely in order to study history from below. One of the reasons I think it's important to study the literature of crime is that it sheds important light on respectable opinion in London, on the attitudes which helped shape, along with a considerable number of other factors, criminal justice policy. And in conducting this investigation into how Londoners thought about crime, we've discovered a key contributing factor to the emerging consciousness of class difference in the late 18th century. It is true as much today as it was in the 1970s that learning about crime, we learn about so much more. not just about both popular and elite mentalities in the past, but also about the possibilities and limitations of historical knowing. Thank you.
At the end, and gave us many things, I'm sure, to think about and talk with you about over the glass of wine, which I'm sure you are aching for after so much water during your lecture. So, thank you again very much. I think we can now say that you may stand down from the dock and go a free man. Thank you.